DW Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
Today on the show, the last Jews of Tunisia.
It's very bad when you lost a part of your history, of your civilization. So I think we should improve their conditions so that they stay in Tunisia.
How Mali's diaspora in Paris copes with the situation back home, and how investments in agriculture can help ensure food security.
All foreign direct investment in agriculture in particular is directed towards a cash crop or a commodity crop. It is not directed towards building the food as far as food sovereignty.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Since the world food price crisis in 2007 and 2008, where the cost of staples like rice or wheat skyrocketed, countries that once relied on buying food have switched their strategy to buying land in other countries. That's in order to secure their country's food production. This practice is often called land grabbing. But these investments have also resulted in negative effects like displacement of local populations and reduced access to resources like water. A few days ago, experts met in Berlin to talk about regulations for agricultural investment. Cinnamon Nippert has more.
Global investment in agriculture can be broken down into four main categories: foreign investment by private companies, foreign public investment or development aid, and then within a country, investment by the national government and farmers themselves. According to Oxfam, 500 million small farms in developing countries currently support almost 2 billion people, or nearly one-third of humanity. While 80% of those who go hungry live in rural areas, most of them working as small-scale food producers. Monique Mikhail from Oxfam.
You know, the broken global food system has meant that vested interests have benefited while small-scale farmers have been left behind. And particularly women farmers have been hit the hardest. Globally, they receive just 7% of total aid to agriculture, forestry, and fishing. So the problem is that small-scale farmers don't have access to the resources that large farms actually enjoy.
Most agricultural investment is done by national governments. However, so-called land grabs by foreign direct investors, or FDIs, have been capturing the headlines. Even though this makes up just a small proportion of the global investment in agriculture, over the past 12 years, 200 million acres, or 1.7% of the world's agricultural land, has been snapped up, most of it in Africa. While over in India, foreign investors have also moved into the food processing sector, the textile industry, and enclosed animal farms. Indian veterinarian and activist Sagari Ramdas from Anthra is highly critical of foreign investment in the Indian agricultural sector.
All foreign direct investment in agriculture in particular is directed towards a cash crop or a commodity crop. It is not directed towards building the food as far as food sovereignty. When I talk about food sovereignty, we're talking about control of land by the farmer and decision-making as to what they will grow, how they will grow, how much they will grow. Control over seeds and other inputs. It's not about building the autonomy of farmers over their land, over their food, over their local markets. When we look at all the foreign direct investment coming in or which has come in thus far, it's about promoting the interests of huge, large companies.
In India, there are many problems with foreign investment. It's not just the practices of big companies like Monsanto and Danone. It's also the complicity of India's wealthy elite and the government strategy to attract large companies with tax breaks and special economic zones, while the ongoing issue of land titles means that communities are often displaced. These kinds of problems are not just limited to India. According to Bettina Rudloff from the German Institute for International and Security Affairs in Berlin, Sudan and Ethiopia are among the top 10 countries targeted by foreign investors for land purchases, yet they can't adequately feed their own people.
That is already an example for problematic or critical investments. These countries are offering land which may as well be a risk for their own food security. And at the same time, they are countries requiring a lot of food aid from other countries.
Last year, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, developed voluntary guidelines for the responsible governance of tenure of land, forest, and fisheries. While the guidelines are voluntary, all member states have signed on, and they're underpinned by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which means that they can be used by civil society in legal processes. Michael Windfuhr, Deputy Director of the German Institute for Human Rights.
The good thing with these international standards is that's not only standards which are relevant for maybe British producers or British investors in Africa or German investors in Asia. They're also eligible for Chinese investors. It's an international standard, so they should guide, the standards should be respected by all business working worldwide.
Striking a balance between large-scale and small-scale farming to meet global needs is a challenge. Yet Windfuhr says it's not impossible. Helen Yego, a small commercial farmer from Kenya who works with the Farmers' Campaign in Goma, outlines a good example of agricultural investment in the Kenyan tea industry.
Some companies in Europe have developed the small-scale farmers to engage in fair trade. And these small-scale farmers are now processing their produce through a multinational factory, but selling direct as fair trade to Europe. So what I want to recommend is that for investment, there's need for fair trade and investment in agriculture so that the majority of the producers who are capable of producing it for export and increasing productivity can be supported.
Monique McHale from Oxfam says that private sector investment in agriculture can help with poverty reduction, but only if investors are ethical and responsible.
Good investment in agriculture would help provide small-scale farmers, particularly women, with access to land and other resources and services like training on agroecological methods that would help both improve their yields and also increase their ability to handle weather and food price shocks when they come. Good investment would also help to empower women farmers. And an example of that is some work we've done in Sri Lanka, where we worked with the government to develop dairy cooperatives with over 1,500 women farmers. Milk production per cow quadrupled, which significantly increased women's incomes. And they've also influenced the government there to provide veterinary services and to purchase the women's milk for local schools.
Mikhail says that large investments need to uphold all labour and community rights and be done with community consent. On the government side, she says that the right kinds of investment need to be attracted and then strongly regulated. Foreign direct investment is just one aspect of the global food system with its complex interdependencies. Local and national food prices are much more dependent on international developments than ever before. The Global North's appetite for quinoa, for example, has seen Bolivians face price hikes in their national staple. Despite increasing weather disruptions due to climate change and a growing world population that needs to be fed, experts hope to find ways to avoid a global food crisis. In response to these and other problems, the FAO's Committee on World Food Security is currently developing principles for responsible investment in agriculture that respect rights, livelihoods and resources, which should be in place by the end of next year. Cinnamon Nippard, DW, Berlin.
About 100,000 Malians live in France at the moment, and they are closely watching the fast-moving events in their homeland, where French and West African forces are trying to help the government beat back Islamist extremists. One of the biggest Malian communities is located in the Paris suburb of Montreuil, earning it the nickname of Little Bamako. Lisa Bryan met some of the people living there to find out how they feel about the conflict back home.
Barra Hostel sits on a small side street in Montreuil, just a couple of blocks from a metro stop. It's a dark, run-down building, but for hundreds of Malian immigrant workers, it's the closest thing to home. The central courtyard has been transformed into an informal street market. A couple of barbers have set up shop with rickety chairs and mirrors. Other Malians sell candies and phone cards. In the dining hall inside, women ladle out steaming mounds of rice and sauce on a cold, snowy evening. Mariam Guineo explains what's inside the pots. There's spinach and onion-based sauces, also a traditional West African peanut sauce called mafé. Guineo's family lives near the central Malian town of Mopti, where French and government forces have beaten back the Islamist insurgency.
We aren't able to reach them by phone. We try to send them money, but even that's difficult because nobody wants to collect it. Everyone's afraid to go out.
Many dinner at long rows of picnic tables. Others crowd around a TV watching a soccer match. But mostly they talk about the conflict in Mali and their families back home. Like many here, construction worker Moussa Diakite praises the French military offensive that has helped repel the rebel push south toward Bamako.
We're waiting to see what the French intervention brings. Right now we have no news, but everyone is reassured that the French have stepped in.
Mali is now waiting for more West African troops to arrive. Europe and the United States have offered logistical and other support, but Diakite wonders why they aren't sending in forces as well.
What I don't understand is now we're fighting a war against terrorism, and the Americans are fighting against terrorism around the world. But why don't they intervene in Mali?
About 6,000 Malians live in Montreuil, a population so significant, it's earned this working-class suburb the nickname Little Bamako. Montreuil's deputy mayor, Claude Resnick, who's in charge of immigration issues, says the town also has cooperation ties in the Kayes region of western Mali, where many immigrants come from.
On se sent autant concerné que eux par la crise malienne.
We feel as concerned about the Malian crisis as the immigrants do. We want Mali to recover its national and territorial integrity, to find peace and unity. We especially want elections so democratic politics in Mali can resume.
Yeli Doucouré, who's in charge of another Malian hostel in Montreuil, says the community here helps each other out.
We Malians are a big family here in France. If one person doesn't have something and the other one does, he helps with food, everything.
At Barra Hostel, cook Mariam Guinio says that after 9 years here, she considers France her second home.
I like it here, simply because women have freedom. At home, women aren't allowed to wear pants. But here, nobody stops us from doing what we want.
Guinio also calls herself 100% Malian, and like others in Montreuil, she waits for news from Mali and hopes for the best. Lisa Bryant, DW, Montreuil.
Still coming up here on World in Progress, a report about the last Jews left in Tunisia. But first, here's Andre Leslie with the development news for this week.
Flood displaces tens of thousands in Mozambique. Mozambique authorities have started emergency evacuations in the flood-struck south of the country, where 55,000 people are said to be in immediate danger from rising river waters. Emergency teams are already in place and motorboats have been dispatched to the area to take people to higher ground. The south and the centre of Mozambique have been placed on red alert after experiencing the heaviest rainfalls seen since devastating floods killed hundreds back in the year 2000. The latest downpours have already killed 35 people since the start of the rainy season in October, and 8 major rivers are running high. Experts predict that the southern town of Chokwe, which saw water rise to roof levels in previous floods, could again bear the brunt of the damage. Coastal Mozambique is home to 9 international river basins, making it especially vulnerable to flooding. UN counter-terrorism expert to launch inquiry into drones. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counter-Terrorism, Ben Emmerson, is launching an inquiry into the impact of the use of drones on civilians and other forms of targeted killing. The study will focus on the applicable legal framework and a critical examination of the evidence surrounding civilian casualties caused by these methods. The results will be presented to the UN General Assembly later this year. The main focus will be on the duty of states to conduct independent and impartial investigations into the lawfulness and proportionality of such attacks. According to the London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism, more than 3,400 people have been killed by US drones in Pakistan since 2004. The number of civilian fatalities is unclear. Measles deaths fall, but vaccine gaps threaten progress. fatal cases of measles have fallen by nearly 75% globally since the year 2000. But big outbreaks in Asian and African states with low vaccination rates jeopardise progress towards eradication, says the World Health Organization, the WHO. The highly contagious disease is a leading cause of death among young children around the world, especially the poor, malnourished and unvaccinated, the organisation says. Measles has been virtually eliminated in North and South America, but Western Europe is lagging due to stagnating vaccine coverage, according to the UN agency. Measles deaths globally decreased drastically between the year 2000 and the end of 2011, from 542,000 to 158,000. Still, in the year 2011, there were major outbreaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, India and Nigeria, as well as in France, Italy and Spain, though fewer children died in Europe. Attacks on Somalis in Kenya rising, according to rights groups. Human rights activists say Somalis in Kenya are facing increased attacks from gangs and harassment from the police since the government issued an order that all Somali refugees should return to a camp. The announcement was made in mid-December. Since then, Kenyan criminal gangs have aggravated xenophobic attitudes towards genuine Somali refugees and asylum seekers who are seeking protection from persecution and conflict in their home country. Kenya announced the new, more stringent controls aimed primarily at Somali refugees inside its borders after enduring months of bomb attacks, which were blamed on the Somali Islamist extremist group Al-Shabaab. Mexico's Peña Nieto wants to end hunger. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto says he plans to eradicate extreme poverty in his country, a blight affecting more than 10% of the population in Latin America's second biggest economy. Hoping to emulate the recent success of Brazil in lifting millions out of poverty, the 46-year-old Peña Nieto has kicked off a national crusade against hunger in Chiapas, one of the state's hardest hit. About half of Mexico's 115 million population is classified as poor, with about 12 million of those living in extreme poverty. UN laments execution of juvenile offender in Iran. The UN human rights body has harshly criticised Iran for reportedly executing a man who was only 17 at the time of his alleged crime. The death penalty cannot be imposed for crimes committed by persons below 18 years of age, insisted Cécile Pouilly, a spokeswoman for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva. 21-year-old Ali Naderi was executed last Wednesday for his alleged role in the murder of a woman 4 years ago. Iran is a party to several international treaties that impose an absolute ban on the death sentence against persons below the age of 18 at the time when the offence was committed. Last week's execution was the first of a juvenile offender in the country since September 2011, the UN said, acknowledging that it appeared authorities had, quote, made efforts to prevent such cases. The UN agency also condemned Iran for increasingly resorting to public executions. More than 400 people were executed in Iran last year.
That was Andre Leslie with today's development news. For more globalization stories, check out our webpage at dw.de/globalization. And for our last story today, we head to Tunisia, where the Arab Spring started a little over 2 years ago. The country has seen a lot of turmoil and change in the past century, and this has also had a major effect on minorities. Tunisia is home to one of the world's oldest Jewish communities. Jewish people were living in the region long before Christianity and Islam emerged. On the eve of the country's independence from France in the 1950s, there were more than 100,000 Tunisian Jews. Today, more than half a century later, as few as 1,500 remain. Naomi Scherbel-Ball travelled to Tunisia to meet with a few Tunisian Jews remaining and ask them about how they see their future in post-revolution Tunisia.
It's very bad when you lost a part of your history, of your civilization. So I think we should improve their conditions so that they stay in Tunisia and they have children and, you know, grandchildren.
Jamel Bataib comes from Sidi Bouzid, the birthplace of the Tunisian Revolution. A young German teacher and activist, he was at the heart of the protests that overthrew the Tunisian president and triggered the Arab Spring. But 2 years on, Bitayeb is concerned post-revolution Tunisia is failing to protect its Jewish population.
The Jewish community in Tunisia is one of the oldest community. They come before the Arabs to Tunisia, you know. In the last few months, an imam was in TV. He was like 1 hour speaking very bad about Jews. Where is the reaction of government? Nothing.
There has been a Jewish community in Tunisia for more than 2,000 years. Before independence from France half a century ago, Tunisia was home to a thriving community of Jews. But now, only a small group remain. A synagogue on the outskirts of Tunis, the seaside resort of La Goulette, is home to a small but active Jewish community. The men are praying and the women gossip with each other. But the congregation is an aging one, with only a couple of children. Roland Saadon is the cantor or singer of prayers at the synagogue. He has spent all his life in Tunisia and wants to stay here. But he tells me, like the rest of the Jews here, his children live abroad, and soon he will be forced to leave Tunisia to be with his family.
It's not the Islamists who began the revolution. If they take over the revolution, things will be difficult, not just for us, but for many Muslims as well. I don't think most Tunisians are extremists, but if they are, then for us, the Jews, there will be no place left in Tunisia.
One of the younger members of the congregation, Isaac Hayoun, is 17.
I'm basically the only young practicing Jewish teenager in the capital. After high school, I'll move to France. There's nothing left here. If I want to marry a Jewish woman, I won't find one in Tunisia. It's a shame because it's a great country. There's the sun and the beach. It really is a beautiful place.
Tunisia's Jews have been gradually leaving the country since independence. Many moved to France and Israel. Some left for financial reasons. There were more opportunities abroad. Others left after the rise in anti-Semitism that followed Israel's two wars with the Arab world. Now only a small core of Tunisian Jews remain. Around the corner from the synagogue is a Jewish restaurant, a meeting place for the community. Jacob Lelouch runs it with his mother, Mami Lili, the chef.
Growing up in La Goulette, it was not growing up in only Jewish community. La Goulette, it's a real special place where there is Jews, Christian and Muslims living together in perfect harmony.
One of five children, Lelouch is the only child to have stayed in Tunisia. His siblings have all moved to France.
I remember that in La Goulette there was three cinema. One of them called the Cinema Rex. The owner of this cinema was a Jewish guy, and three times a year he opened the doors of his cinema freely to the children of La Goulette for Christmas, for Laïd, and for Purim also. And every year we wait for these three events. Even if we were Jews, we wait for Laïd also and for Christmas. And the Christian wait for Purim and for Laïd. And there was no difference between us.
These protesters in Tunis last year chant, "Death to the Jews." Tunisia's moderate Islamist government, however, has assured the Jewish community that it is safe to stay in Tunisia.
This revolution comes from dignity and democracy. Then the Jews of Tunisia are also, and first at all, Tunisians. Then we have the same rights of dignity and democracy.
Lelouch supported the revolution and even ran for election to the assembly drafting Tunisia's new constitution. But when the microphone is off, Other Tunisian Jews tell me they felt safer under former President Ben Ali, who imprisoned many hardline Islamists.
Jews are a very important part of Tunisian history.
But while some Tunisian Jews hesitate to speak out, Tunisian non-Jewish activists like Jamil Bataib are taking up their cause.
From the beginning, Al Kahina, the Berber, it was a very strong Berber lady and leader, and it's like an example for Tunisian ladies now. She was militant, strong. She was Jewish, and she fought against the Arab occupation to Tunisia. And then during the French occupation, Jews participate with their countrymen in the struggle of independence. Nobody said, I'm Muslim or I'm Jewish or I'm atheist. We were Tunisians, you know.
Having been active in the protests that started the revolution, he is now concerned that Tunisia's new freedom of speech is providing a platform for extremists to voice hate campaigns against Tunisia's Jews. And he is worried about where this anti-Semitism will lead.
Hitler begins with the speech. It begins with the speech, and step by step, then he burned the books, and then he make racist laws, and then begin the concrete execution of people. So when a TV channel shows anti-Semitic speech, a minister say anti-Semitic speech, member of parliament say very dangerous and anti-Semitic speech, never the government, either the civil society make any reaction.
For the moment, much of the anti-Semitism has remained rhetoric. But the potential for violence remains very real. The central synagogue in Tunis on Liberty Avenue is surrounded by barbed wire and protected by armed soldiers. Built in the 1930s, the synagogue stands as a symbol of the community's confidence. Today, however, a shadow of that thriving community lives on. In a hall backing onto the synagogue, the Jews of Tunis celebrate a rare occasion, a bar mitzvah, the celebration marking the coming of age of a Jewish boy. The latest effort to conserve Jewish Tunisia is being led by Jacob Lelouch, who has started a museum and a website dedicated to Jewish history and culture in the country. He says that whatever happens, it will ensure that Tunisian Jews are remembered for generations to come. But for the moment at least, this tiny community is hanging on to see what post-revolution Tunisia has in store. Naomi Sherbel-Bull, DW, Tunis.
And you can find out more about this and other globalization stories at dw.de/globalization. If you want to listen to World in Progress again, you can download the show as podcast or listen at dw.de/worldinprogress. Thanks for tuning in today. World in Progress will be back next week at the same time. Until then, on behalf of today's studio team here in Bonn, Eliane Giarducci and Jaron Kutt, I'm Anke Rasper saying thanks for your interest and goodbye.